All right. Could we get the buzz down to a roar here? Okay. Let me tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to go over some material on this question of, to a certain degree, referencing contour in sort of in a beginning fashion. And, you know, we'll have other discussions of this, I'll mention, in the upcoming weeks, and pretty much in the context of this idea that of physical economy, and maybe try to locate it in some of the discussion we've had this weekend. Anyway, but the way we're going to run this today, it's not quite, it was about 11:25. So at 12:30, we're going to have lunch. And we'll probably give that around an hour. We should say for sure, we'll break it. We'll have lunch at 12:30 and reconvene at 1:30. And even if you're still eating, reconvene. Because we want to have at least, I would say, an hour to an hour and a half, given the situation. And we'll give you some of the thinking that I know of coming off of Lynn's comments yesterday about, you know, relatively speaking, radical action to get ourselves politically on the right footing starting this week. Some of this will be discussed, as we mentioned, Lynn mentioned, on Tuesday at the webcast and at a meeting with the youth movement on Wednesday and so on and so forth. So, but we do want to even begin that discussion out here today. So I would also reference something that I think in 2 weeks from this weekend, actually, I guess from this, for the relevant people here, for Oakland and Los Angeles, Bruce Director is going to be out. He'll be in Seattle Thursday, Oakland Friday, and Los Angeles Saturday and Sunday, 2 weeks from this weekend. And, you know, some of these will be, he's going to be discussing more developed versions of some of the things I'm going to bring up here, and we can continue some of that discussion. Now, what I want to address, at least in preliminary fashion, is some of this, the LaRouche's conception of physical economy. But physical economy really as a kind of centerpiece around which you can locate this question that came up and has been up and really is up implicitly in this fundamentalism question. In the question of science and morality. Because really these are not separate questions. And it's not separate in a way, I would put it a little bit more differently than most people would, I think. In other words, most people say, yes, science has to be moral. But you see, that's to imply a dichotomy. It's sort of this Frankenstein image of science. That somehow, you know, science can run amok with knowledge and you have to have morality to bring it under control. Actually, what I think is you can't really have science that doesn't root itself in a conception of humanity. It ultimately won't be scientific. It won't succeed. It will fail as science. If it doesn't comprehend the existence of man in nature, and in that sense also the nature of man, what is it in nature that created man? And you can call it what you want. You can call it God, the composer, the divine. I don't know. I don't care what you call it. I'm the least sectarian person you'll probably ever run into. You can call it whatever you want. Okay? But the question is, what is it in the universe that produced us, and why do we have to act the way we do? if we're to continue as human, as a human society. Now, in one sense, I like to begin it by saying something that may seem a bit strange, but I think it's important to grasp, particularly when we discuss this fundamentalism, because I think one of the great ironies in fundamentalism is that it's rooted in a pessimistic view of the universe. And yet, part of the problem in organizing these people comes from the fact that they can play upon your own pessimism. And I think that's where you get this kind of double irony in the situation, why they freak people out so much. Now, if you look at human history, and here we are, and I think this is the right moment to say something like this. If you look at human history, you know, everybody's freaked out. You know, Bush is the president, Cheney's the vice president. Everywhere you go, it looks bad. And it may be that. It is pretty bad. I'm not arguing that. But if you look at the history of the human species, it's generally an upward trajectory. That may not seem too helpful. You say generally. Of course, there's a lot of bad points in it. Sometimes it goes down for a long time. But if you look at the sweep of human history, if you look at 2 million years of human history, as far as, you know, these are arguable points. I'm not, you know, but it seems from what I know, you have cognitive beings on the planet. And now I'm not going to argue about relative time and, you know, were the first 7 days of God's creation really 1 million years? I don't, you know, these things that come up are not of terribly great interest to me. Okay, as far as I can measure it, we have cognitive creatures on the planet for about 2 million years. And in the early phases, their numbers were not that much different and their life wasn't that much different than a common ape or a baboon. And you can probably tell from what limited record there is, and these are all somewhat guesses, but from what limited record that there is, that the average lifespan of early humans was probably, most of the people in this audience would be elderly. Okay? And probably that's true up to very relatively recently. You would represent the upper age brackets of surviving creatures of early human beings. Probably most people didn't make it past about 25. Okay? The numbers were tiny. The places that we could live. And life was, you know, probably difficult. Probably very difficult. Any form of radical alteration in temperature was devastating. Diseases probably wiped out whole groups of populations overnight, effectively. So, in one sense, human history is quite different than we think about it when we think about it from the standpoint of our mortal lifespan. And, you know, however young you are right now, you do have a lifespan. I'm not about to try to put any limits on it. Maybe, you know, these days people have a fairly decent chance of living to be 80. You know, if we forestall the kinds of consequences of a dark age that Lynn's talking about, most of you have a pretty good chance of making it to 75, 80, maybe 90. I don't know what it's going to look like. You know, like a lot of people, I probably won't be here when you face that question. Okay? But that's roughly what you're looking at. Now, humanity has overcome great crises. You know, when we talk about the present period, I was raising this to people earlier, you know, the other side doesn't always win, even when things look fairly grim. For example, just to take a simple example, the existing Sinarchist faction, which was putting fascism on the face of Europe in the 1920s and 30s, wanted to kill Roosevelt. And they didn't want to wait until 1945. You know, one can argue about what happened to them. But, you know, they didn't want to wait until then. They wanted them out in 33 or 34, and they failed. And because of that, they failed to impose fascism in the United States. And so this thing that Lynn refers to as this, you know, embedded culture, which gives us the ability to fight fascism, as grim as it may look, has come to the fore under these kinds of circumstances in the past. So the general arc of human history is, relatively speaking, positive. The fact of the matter is, however, it always depends on actions of human beings. How bad it gets, how long it takes to turn it around, depends on human beings. If you go back to the 14th century, it's the same thing. Some group of people managed to take Europe out of a situation where tens of millions of people died. As Lynn has often pointed out, this comes, others have studied this, approximately half the parishes of Europe were destroyed in the plagues of the 14th century. About maybe as much as a quarter to a third of the population. And yet, out of that, really out of that, as you might say, as a reaction to that in part, modern Europe, the modern Western civilization came. So you have to look at this. Now, the reason I raise this in the issue of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is based on the idea that you can never know what to do. You can never know how to guide human action. These things are the intentions of the Creator and beyond the ken of man. And in fact, it's viewed a bit as the old Greek idea. It's viewed as hubris, overweening pride, to think that we can. You're really not supposed to go there. You're supposed to give yourself over to these, you know, what Harley was talking about, other people have talked about. This perhaps wrathful, perhaps not so wrathful God. And, it is the case that these guys always tend to like the Old Testament God because, you know, I was raised in the Old Testament God. I found them an interesting, didn't bother me that much. You know, I kind of found it, I've always had a little inclination to those kinds of things. You know, God didn't like what he saw and he smote them down. You know, it's, you know, sometimes you definitely feel like that's not the worst way to go sometimes. But, you know. So this is the kind of God that they had. They find themselves comfortable with this. They don't like a God who's hung up by compassion and concern and so on and so forth. Now, the fact of the matter is, what is it, to a large extent, what's the problem you have organizing a fundamentalist? Yes, they're a problem, but it's really the effect that they have on you that's the problem. Because, you know, they come up, they're a little glazed over. You know, they used to refer to the upper part of New York State where a lot of these millenarian culture, I think particularly in the 19th century, these so-called millenarians, the Darbyites. There was a big revival of fundamentalism. I don't know if Harley mentioned it in the 19th century. A lot of this was in upstate, well, a lot of the commune almost, and out of which they would go and then move west in the case of the Mormons. You know, it's funny, the Mormons began in New York State and they moved out of there across into Utah and so on and so forth. So New York State was called the burnt over territory. It had so many revival movements during this period that it was like a wasteland. People would just go through these revival movements and they would either just get completely emotionally wiped out or they would move based on some vision of somebody. So this is called the burnt over ground or the burnt over territory. And I always think of it when I think of these guys because it reminds me that they're the glazed over territory. Their minds are sort of glazed over with a patina of belief. And it's very hard to get across, right? That you look at them and they say, yeah, but, you know, I'm saved. And, my family is saved because I just believe all the right things. And, you know, man, human beings can't grasp any of this. You can't grasp it. You have to be humble. You have to just believe.
You have to take Jesus into your heart, or whatever. It doesn't have to be Jesus. You get the same thing on all these fundamentalist groupings. I was raised with a lot of these Jewish fundies, Hasidim, you know. And their whole thing is just, the word there, you have to, it's Torah. You have to have Torah. Torah is the five books. Or some people, you know, it's basically the five books. All right? Some of them include some other things. And you have to just take that in. And if you live by that, you know, and if you accept that, even though there isn't heaven in the Jewish religion, you get heaven anyway. They sort of guaranteed you something they concocted, you know, 2,500 years after the Old Testament. They came up with heaven. There's no heaven in the Old Testament. There's no hell in the Old Testament. They made it up. It tells you something about fundamentalists. They add footnotes when they need it. Okay? So, you see this stuff, but the problem is, if you're relatively want to think about things, you feel a little overwhelmed. Now, partly you're overwhelmed by the irrationality of it all. And you have to realize that. Here's somebody who says they know nothing, but they know everything. And they know everything because they know nothing. They're so dumb they can't think of anything, and that makes them so smart they know everything. Okay? It's sort of a vast perversion of Socrates. You know, so, they look at you, and see, you say, well, I've got to prove this to them. I've got to prove it, but, you know, you yourself, you say, well, I don't know everything. So how can I prove it to them? What formula can I, what proof can I have? How can I make them see that they're wrong? Well, once in a while, if you get an honest one, they might face a certain paradox. And by honest, I mean somebody who's emotionally somewhat honest. But most of them, they're impenetrable. The problem isn't so much that you can't penetrate them. They're impenetrable. The only thing that's going to penetrate them is reality. They're going to have to face certain things, and you have to have the approach of, I'm going to tell them everything I can, such that if they should have a great awakening, okay, they might remember what I told them. The problem is you have to have the confidence that you're right. You have to have the confidence that you know what you're talking about. The problem isn't them. You get hung up on it because you think, if I can't prove to this person that somehow that's a mark against me, it makes me feel that I know less. Well, they don't think that way. They look at you and say, well, this guy ain't going to get saved. One little bit more room in heaven for me. And in one sense, you have to be a little bit ruthless about understanding that's how they're thinking. You don't get angry at them because they don't know what they're talking about. But you have to know that they don't know what they're talking about. If you live in a world that accepts a corner of irrationality, it occurs to you, well, what if they're right? What if they're going to go to heaven and I'm not? They just stand there, they see, they believe it. Who knows? And, you know, you get into the world of Pascal's bet. You know, he had this ironic, people took this seriously, actually. It was ironic. He said, well, you know, if you look at the odds on this, right, if I believe in God, well, if I don't believe in God, and there is no God, you sure ain't getting anything out of it. Right? If I don't believe in God, if I do believe in God and there is no God, I haven't lost all that much. I'm going through life with this belief. If I don't believe in God and there is a God, I'm in big trouble. And if I believe in God and there is a God, I've hit the jackpot. So, the odds are in your favor to believe in God, says Pascal. Okay? It's a bit of humor. Some people took it seriously. But anyway, he's being ironic. Okay? Now, the problem is, what is it that you know? Now, here's where this question of reason and faith becomes, I think, a little bit more interesting than is often posed as a kind of dichotomy. Okay? The issue really is this. Here's the problem for most people when they think of knowledge. They think, well, I have to know things. I have to know facts. I have to know everything. I have to have a formula. That's knowledge. I have to. Here's the universe. There's a fixed array of things about the universe. There's a couple of laws, et cetera, et cetera. And if I get them all right, then I know everything. And that's knowledge. But since nobody knows everything, what do you do? In fact, we can prove that the idea of complete knowledge is impossible. So what do you do? Well, then do you have to have faith that somehow you're going to get it right? Well, then you've lost the whole argument. You know, the problem is in the conception of knowledge. Now, there is a quality of faith, if you want to call it that, in reason. But it's not faith that reason is right. It's if you understand what reason is, you believe that you can solve problems. Because that's all that knowledge gives you. Reason, what you know is that the universe is so constructed that problems will always appear to finite human beings, and that there is an approach to knowing how the universe works such that those problems are soluble by human creativity. And that's what you know about the universe. That's what the universe is like. The universe is a constantly developing process, especially in the relationship that a finite being has to that universe. You're always discovering principles, solutions to problems, universal principles that allow you to understand what new problems and what new solutions might be ahead. And moreover, that quality in the universe is the nature of the physical universe. And therefore, it's our relationship to it. Human society, you can think of as the means by which finite human beings collaborate to solve problems in discovering universal principles and keep them alive for future generations. So social principles become part of the physical universe. And belief is not belief that the method is right. That's provable. But belief is belief that if you apply those principles and find the means to apply them, you will solve the problems. Now, that's what you know about the universe. Now, if you understand that and you understand that anybody who believes in a set of beliefs is doomed to fail, no given set of beliefs is adequate to the universe. Then you know that these poor people who have given themselves over to this fundamentalist idea are lost souls. You know, I think our problem with most of these people is too often in the back of our minds we think somehow they're going to win the bet. And we're going to lose. They've lost the bet. Because it's not the universe that they think it is. Pascal's wager is meant to be an ironic comment on that kind of relationship to God. Because God's great trick is he likes people to solve problems. So the universe is constructed to throw problems up so that you can discover the solutions and find out more about creation. And if you don't want to play it that way, you're a lost soul. And so these people are lost souls. And I think we're too worried that they've got an inside track. There's too much doubt in the way we approach them. Because isn't the thing that gets you about these people is that they're seeming mindless confidence? I mean, I've seen this. You know, you say, oh, my God. They seem so sublimely confident that everything, you know, they're just going to be in great shape. Yeah, like Bush, right? And it's a little infuriating, but you feel like, gee, he seems to be at ease with himself, and I'm all neurotic and freaked out. Now, the truth of the matter is this is a guy, these are people with somewhat a sick soul. And frankly, underneath of it all, I don't know whether they're satisfied. I'm not that interested in knowing. How does he feel about it? I don't know how he feels about it. Maybe he's such a lunatic he is at ease with himself. That's of less interest to me than it is to a lot of people. What I do know is that he's a sick soul. Because if he's at ease with doing what he's doing, he's a problem. And that someday he'll have to face that. So I think what we have to look at is, you know, what we really know, what knowledge is. And you have a much, much more profound sense of that. Too often people are looking for a simple solution, a formula. How does this work? How does that work? What's a principle? What new principle came in? You know, there's a lot of things to look at. There's a lot of things that LaRouche has. And I was talking to someone, what LaRouche has is a demonstrable method and a demonstrable approach. And this is the whole point about forecasting. A demonstrable approach to knowing what kinds of problems we're going to face. And in that method alone, a demonstrable approach to knowing what kinds of things we need to address to solve those problems. And they're always problems of universal import. But a principle, an idea, is always something that's relatively universal. That is, it's universal to the universe that we're dealing with right now, to what we know up to this point. I mean, that's the essence of the question of a classical idea. You know, as Miwa was relating to it. It's not just universal in time in the sense of, well, it's everybody knows it and everybody reacts to it. Classical means ideas that are based on being universal principles. The development of an idea about the way in which the universe as we know it functions and communicating that to other human beings. One of the big questions of this question of fundamentalism is the big question to ask any of these people is, okay, can you communicate it intelligibly to another person? Now, the other person can't have your conversation with God. That was your personal conversation, right? Okay, now, what if somebody didn't have a personal conversation? Didn't have a vision? You had a vision? Fine. No argument. You had a vision. I'm not here to interfere with your visions. Okay? But you have to admit, nobody else can have your vision. So how do you communicate that intelligibly to another poor, lost soul? So somehow you got to get outside of faith. You got to be able to communicate it. Unless you think just staring at the person long enough, they're going to have the same vision you had. What if somebody reads the Bible and doesn't get out of it what you get? You've got to be able to demonstrate to him that what you say is true. What if you come upon somebody who comes from a totally different society, a totally different background? It has to be intelligibly communicable knowledge or it's irrelevant. It's useless. I'm not arguing about whether you have it or not. You can go your way. Now, in essence, what I want to address relatively briefly here is this question. Because, look, what is LaRouche's approach to physical economy? And I want to, in some ways, give you as much as I know, which isn't that much, about what Lynn, my own view of how, from what I can understand of what he said, I'm not putting words in his mouth or saying that this is the true grid or something like that, but from what I've been able to get, Lynn came out of World War II. and there's probably more in his background, but, you know, basically he came out of World War II, and he came and he saw not just the death of Franklin Roosevelt, but he also saw relatively immediately a certain direction in U.S. policy and in thinking, largely in the English-speaking world. Artificial intelligence and so on and so forth, but especially this idea of free enterprise, an attack on what we know now as the American system of political economy. The idea that in the economic policies, you can't have knowledge. You can't have the idea that there's certain things that we know we need to do. That all of human economic activity is simply the sum total of people's desires, pleasures, as they bounce into one another and conflict with one another. And then somehow, in the course of people making these choices, there's a certain allocation of credit and investment and so on and so forth. And these are all really the accidental outcomes of the compilation of people's limited immediate choices. And this, of course, is coherent with information theory in terms of its concept of human nature, which is also just, it had begun before, but was coming back at full strength after World War II with the artificial intelligence projects, the information technology projects, Norbert Wiener, all these people, Johann von Neumann, all this coming out of sort of the radical positivism of the 20s and 30s around what was called the Vienna Circle, which, of course, was part of a completely degenerate, pessimistic turn in European culture, in European epistemology, alongside of existentialism. And Lynn said, well, look, this isn't, in fact, the outlook not only of Western civilization, and he was rooted in Leibniz, but he said, look, this isn't human existence. This isn't the way human beings really exist. Look, economics, what is economics? Economics is a science of human reproduction. And it incorporates everything that human beings do to exist. It's not about money. It's not about credit as such. Those are all subordinate to what's physical economy. It's the way in which the human species, as a totality, reproduces itself. You know, fundamentally, in the case of human beings, biological reproduction, though necessary, obviously, is secondary. We reproduce ourselves by a cognitive reproduction of society as a whole and everything involved in it. Everything we need to exist, the food, the plants, the energy sources, water, all these things are produced by human intervention. And the question is, how do you create the conditions under which you reproduce this 25 conditions today to reproduce this 25, 50 years from now, about, you know, given certain limitations, about as far in advance as we can see. And it's coherent with the idea, let's say, you know, you're thinking basically the grandchildren of people alive today are going to be functional for about 50 years, a couple of generations into the future. And you have some idea of what they're going to need to know, what conditions they're going to have. Now, in the course of doing this and looking at the problems to be faced, LaRouche looked at a couple of things, or it was affected at least by a couple of things, in the following order. And this is the way it really has to be understood. Okay, what LaRouche did, and was from the standpoint of Leibniz, the earliest idea of physical economy, LaRouche looked at a couple of things. He said, look, what we've got in the case of human existence is a sequence of fundamentally progressive changes, fundamentally progressive developments. That is, scientific knowledge in advance creates technologies which allows the human species to overcome the problems created by human existence. human existence does. Every scientific, every mode of reproduction effectively changes nature around us. We absorb some of nature. We change it. We change our relationship to it. To a certain degree, we use up resources relative to the given technology, to the given science. And therefore, the nature of human existence from the very beginning, from that which distinguishes us from the animal, is that we have to change our relationship to nature continuously. And we do that through two means. We do that, number one, by creating the scientific knowledge that allows us to create the technologies that directly changes what we can do, what our control of nature is. What we're able to extract from nature that didn't seem to be there before. For example, you know, to the average baboon, electricity didn't exist. I mean, they may have been struck by lightning once, but they didn't think of that as something they could use to change things. Metal doesn't exist to a chimpanzee or even to early man. Steel doesn't come. It doesn't grow in the ground. Iron ore wouldn't be iron ore unless you knew what to do with it. There's no such thing as a natural resource. Doesn't exist. What's a natural resource? You know, to a lion, a zebra is a natural resource. But to the lion, the zebra is the natural resource, and that's all there is. You know, there's wildebeest and there's zebras, and if they're not really too good as lions, there might be a little Thompson gazelle because they can't catch anything bigger. Okay? There ain't much. That has been the way it's been, lo, these many years. Human beings are different. For example, take animals. Just even take animals, right? Cows don't grow in nature. It's actually easy, right? Domesticated animals are not natural. They don't even look like other herbivores. They don't live the same way. You know, you don't see some cow walking around in India ready to be milked four times a day. They don't grow that way in nature. Even that is different. In fact, some of the things that you even see in nature that you think of as natural are different. This is a good example of changing the environment. For example, deer are not really these wonderfully successful animals. They're successful, in other words, they certainly populate. There's a lot of deer around. Why? Because human beings have created the conditions under which deer don't have that much to be frightened of. Like there's not a lot of mountain lions, there's not a lot of wolves, there's not a lot of predators. Most of the predators can't survive in the conditions created by human beings, so the deer reproduce. Otherwise, there wouldn't be that many of them. The fact of the matter is, we change our relationship to nature. Now, we also do that, and this is one of the key things that Lynn was focused on. Because now, once these ideas exist, how do you communicate these ideas to other human beings? They're not just accepted ideas. They're not just given formulas. Now we got changing ideas. You have to create in the population the ability to assimilate new knowledge, new ideas. One of the worst things is you get this in craft mentality. People say, no, this is what I know, and I'm never going to change. This is my identity. I'm a plumber. I'm a carpenter. I'm a farmer. And I know how to do things. But what happens when you have to communicate to these people that there have been changes? You have to live in a society in which electricity exists, in which fossil fuels exist, in which the internal combustion engine exists. We lose sight of things. For example, people are asking what new principle. You have to realize the principle of our ability to control radioactive material, nuclear material. This is relatively new. We've only been able to deal with the nucleus of an atom as a source of anything since about the mid-1930s. Or maybe a little bit before that, in terms of some of the material that, radioactive decay, x-rays and so forth, maybe in the early part of the 20th century. 100 years.
And this is actually an area of the spectrum of nature that we haven't really developed all that much. What we did was we introduced a new principle of knowledge into our relationship to nature that actually has changed everything. And we still haven't quite dealt with it. Now, how do you communicate? How do you create the conditions under which people can accept the development of new ideas? And that's largely the realm of classical culture, classical art. Classical art is, in a sense, getting across to people the ability of their mind to assimilate and absorb and communicate ideas about man's relationship to man and nature. That's what makes classical art. That's in many ways why there is a difference about classical art. In other words, the first time somebody argues for an art form, I say, well, this is just my art. This is my culture. This is my neighborhood. This is how we feel about things. Okay, fine. But that's not classical art. That's the opposite of classical art. That's the opposite of art. Expressing yourself is an art. Babies do that. They express themselves. In fact, they may express themselves more purely than you do. Okay? They're relatively an unmediated expression of what's going on. In fact, you know, you can say we have infantile expressions of art because, you know, babies generally aren't bowel trained, so they express themselves. And some modern artists think that the main expression of their art is showing that they're not bowel trained. Okay? Now, the fact of the matter is, there is something in art which is part of the way in which the human species develops. Now, what Lynn was looking at, and this is where I want, you have to look at everything that we're doing as much as you can to situate it from this standpoint. Because the first thing that Lynn was looking at was the development of modern science at one level, as a beginning approximation. Not that science was primary, but this is what he's looking at. Because what did you have in the development of modern science in the case of Gauss, Riemann, and company? And this is what he was really looking at. They were looking precisely at the idea of, can you develop a conception in mathematics that's subordinate to the development of physical processes in the way in which human beings discover new physical processes. That is to say, what these guys are looking at, what Gauss is looking at, what Riemann is looking at, and Riemann represented the highest development of, is a kind of view of the way in which physical processes work that dominate the mathematics. And so, for example, what we're studying in Gauss, that the mathematical formulas, the algebra, is actually a derived aspect of the complex domain. The complex domain is the domain of constructive geometry, of coherent development of constructive geometrical proportions that are affected by unseen physical principles. And so the complex domain of mathematics is a mathematics which is appropriate to a physical universe in which there are universal unseen principles that change the way in which the mathematical formulations operate. So algebra, it turns out, has rules that can only be expressed properly from the standpoint of a higher order mathematical domain. So that's why we look at Gauss. And there's nothing internal to the algebra. That's why he corrects Euler, D'Alembert, etc. What Riemann is doing, I'll read a quote or two from him. What Riemann does, and what you see with some of what Bruce's work, what Riemann is doing is he's saying, well, look, what kind of approaches do we take to a mathematics that actually reflects an ongoing change in geometries? As he says in the habilitation paper, there is no fixed geometry. Geometry is not about a fixed surface.
or a kind of surface. Geometry is about the way in which geometries or surfaces transform themselves, go through fundamental changes. We move from one geometric configuration to something fundamentally different. We reach a point of fundamental change. Now, what kind of sense of geometry do we have to have? Geometry is a geometry of transition, of development, of alteration of manifold and metric. Now, Lin's view was that Riemann's approach is essential to understanding physical economy. Now, the problem in this was the only problem that existed in Riemann was really a certain kind of philosophical conception of how hypotheses work and what the nature of the physical universe is that allows you to undergo certain kinds of transformations. And at that point, Lin had the fortune of looking at certain elements of Georg Cantor, who was a mathematician of the late 19th century, who developed the idea of the transfinite. Now, this was a profound philosophical conception, but Cantor himself had many, many problems. Some of those problems were less significant in the early part of his life, though there were elements of flaws of it there, and became a bigger problem later in life. Because Cantor's tendency was to succumb to a certain effort to formalize this, to come up with a logical formal system, and he was very much affected by a series of attacks on his discovery by basically positivists, by people who wanted to reduce everything to simple logical formalism. So he got himself in some problems, which has made him a problematic figure to look at. But in order to understand what LaRouche did, you have to understand Riemann, the importance of Riemann and Gauss, and then look at what Cantor adds to it as a philosophical, an epistemological conception, somewhat reflected in certain discoveries in mathematics, and then how that reflects back on an ability to use or comprehend Riemann at a deeper level. Now, what's the kind of thing that Riemann is really working on? Then you'll see in a simple introductory sense what this idea of the transfinite is. Well, one good way to look at this, I think, is this idea of boundary conditions. But let's start. In essence, what Riemann says is, look, you can discover the nature of a geometry. You can know the nature of geometry by simply knowing the boundary conditions and the singularities. Now, I'm going to tell you what these things. One good example of this, and I would recommend people the latest pedagogical that Bruce did. One example of this is the hanging chain. Now, we talk about the catenary. I'm not going to go through everything about the catenary. But one of the things, you know, if you take a chain or a string and you hang it from two points, it's going to take on a characteristic curvature. And by the way, this was a big controversy because what was the nature of this curve was an issue in the 17th century, in particular because, you know, you're talking about something hanging on the planet Earth in a gravitational field which was just being discovered. And so, all right, what's the curve? And I think one of the funnier things is somebody like Galileo kind of eyeballed it and said, well, it's a parabola. Now, in part, he was eyeballing it. In part, he's saying, well, look, we have a certain set of algebraic curves, and, you know, this, you know, y equals x squared, that's one of them, that's the parabola, and this thing looks like that, so that's what it is. And in fact, from any simple eyeballing or even effort to squeeze these things together, it's hard to tell how different it is, particularly when you're dealing with small little slices of the curve. You can sort of argue it's pretty parabolic, okay? Except, of course, it wasn't. Now, one of the things that you get out of this is something very interesting, is that if you move the hanging nail, if you change where you're holding it, huh? Oh. You know, these things rarely work when you do them. But you know, if you hold it up here, you get something that looks like that. Now, if I change where I hold it, the curve changes. It doesn't fall exactly on the same line. What have I done? I changed the boundary condition, the hanging nail. See, as a mathematical formulation, it's all my, when you deal with it mathematically, you're just talking about a curve that goes off into infinity. It effectively isn't hanging off of anything. Okay? In the physical world, I'm going to put a boundary condition. I'm going to hold it here and here, or I'm going to hold it, you know, and hold it up here, and you get a slightly different curve, as you can see it. If I drop it, if I hold it further up, I'm going to get something somewhat different. And in fact, you see, here's what's going to happen. As this thing sways, it's going to slow down eventually, and it's going to come to a new curve. I'm doing a pretty good job here. You see what's going to happen. It's going to settle down into a new curve. That curve is defined by the boundary conditions, by where I'm holding it. Okay? And this is where you get something called Dirichlet's principle. It's ultimately determined by where I hold it. In other words, you can, let me put it to you this way. You can know the shape of the curve by knowing where you're holding it and where the minimum point is. Once you know those two things, you know the whole rest of the curve. Now, how is it you know that? What Leibniz and others hypothesized is a least action principle. That the chain is going to distribute the tension in a certain way. Its relationship to the gravitational field. Because it's the weight of the chain in the gravitational field that creates the pull. And that chain is going to move to a position that's going to distribute the tension in the gravitational field in a certain way. And that's going to basically distribute in a relatively even way. So they apply a physical principle, and they say, given the physical principle, if I know the boundary conditions and the minimum point, I can tell you what the whole rest of the curve looks like. You can think of the minimum point as the singularity. Now, let's take a good example, which is going to be a little bit different. And I want to throw a physical economy. And then we'll look at some things that Riemann worked on. A physical economy has a slightly different boundary condition. Actually, it's an interesting thing to look at from the standpoint of Fermat. Because remember, what happened in the reflection and the refraction? In the reflection, with the mirror, you're staying in the same medium. Therefore, there's no change in the propagation of light. Light propagates the same way in the same medium. So one of the things that factors out is time. Since there's no acceleration, deceleration in the light, it's moving in the same way in the same medium, you can leave that out of account. If you leave that out of account, the light travels in essentially a straight line. The angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection. Now, what happens when you move into a different medium? That's what's the difference in refraction. In refraction, you're moving from air to water, or maybe a series of mediums. In some cases, by the way, when you look at air, light traveling in the atmosphere, the density of the atmosphere changes the composition and it changes the medium. So as you move from the upper atmosphere to the lower atmosphere, you get a refraction, even though we think of it as all air. It's changed in composition. And so it refracts. Why? Because we find an interesting principle. The light doesn't travel in straight lines. It travels in a line that minimizes the time in the medium. It wants to travel in through any given medium in such a way that it's going to go through that medium in the least amount of time. Therefore, if you're talking about the combined motion of light in two mediums, one of which it moves slower in and one of which it moves faster in, the light will find a path that travels the least amount of time in the slower medium. Thereby, its total action, or the total amount of work, is less. Is the least action. Now, this isn't really a question of efficiency. There's all kinds of different factors in this. I have a problem with this word efficiency because it gets used in the most pragmatic kind of way. Okay? The light is actually doing something other than being efficient. What the light is doing is it's finding an action which gives it the most ability to do work. Not the least ability to do work. Now, you have something similar in the economy. Because in an economy, as compared to the hanging chain where we can leave certain things out, in the economy, what are your boundary conditions? Well, the boundary conditions fundamentally include time. Now, let me give you a sense of how this works. Okay, you have in an economy, you have certain resources, population, etc. And those resources are relative to the science and technology that you have. Now, the question is this. How do you organize society so that you know that it's going to be capable of reproducing itself? Well, what you need to know is you need to be able to use the existing resources to get you to a point in the future where you can change the resource base, which means you have to be able to change the science and technology. Because any resource is finite. See, this idea of finite resources is idiocy. Every resource is finite, particularly when you're limited to the planet or even the solar system. Okay? It's limited. I don't care how much there is, it's a finite amount. There's not an infinite amount of anything in the solar system. Okay? So now you have to look at... So therefore, environmentalists are crazy. See, environmentalists are essentially existentialists. Why? Because they say, well, look, we're using up the resources. And, you know, no matter what, you're going to have finite resources. So what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to restrict your use of the resource. Right? But all you're doing, if you use the resource more slowly, you're doing two things. You're still using it up. So you may be, you know, the species will last 100 years instead of 50 years, or 200 years instead of 100 years. But built into it is, we're finished. It's just a question of when we're finished. Now, the second thing is, by reducing the rate at which you use the resource, you close off any solution to the problem. Because what you're doing is you're slowing down the rate of development. You're slowing down the rate of growth. You're slowing down the rate of development of the population and so on. You're reducing living standards. I mean, this is the essence of all this. It takes all kinds of wild political forms. But what are you saying? Well, it's got to be cheaper. We have to have lower standard of living labor that we can pay cheaper. Because they're going to use less resources. Of course, the whole thing is completely insane because they often use more resources. Okay? But even in their own terms, they're eating less, but they're producing less. So we have no solution to the problem that we face. We've lowered the standard of living in the United States. We're using resources. Per capita, we use less energy than we used to. But we've also got a less productive economy. We're not producing scientific and technological breakthroughs. Now, how do you look at this? You have a situation. Let's say we want to get to a new technology. What's our time horizon? Within X amount of years, let's say a generation, We know that we're going to be in a situation where fossil fuels will be increasingly less productive, increasingly more expensive, and maybe even running out. So how do we get to a situation where fossil fuels are replaced by something else, and what can replace them? Well, we have to move to nuclear power. But how do we get to nuclear power? Well, ironically enough, and you can think this through yourself, making a long story short, you're going to have to use your existing resources faster than you plan right now. Why? Because you have to build nuclear plants. They take a lot of concrete, a lot of steel, a lot of other material, a lot of labor, a lot of power to build them. Because we're not talking about building one of them. So all of a sudden you realize that the 25 years you thought you had to get to nuclear energy as, let's say, 50% or more of the energy resources, you're going to have to use your present resources faster. Therefore, you have to get to nuclear energy in 20 years. This is actually how you do economic planning. And now you can see what animations are a little bit. I'm going to race ahead a little bit because we don't have that much time. Because how would you do an animation? You would do an animation about the entire allocation of resources and how they intersected this point in the future and how they affected everything you were doing in the meantime. So you'd have to have a complex domain animation of how this thing is developing. Now, of course, there's an interesting trick in this, because you also see what the problem is in planning. Okay, now you got to get there in 20 years. Except there's a dilemma here, right? Because since you originally planned on 25 years, and you now realize you're going to use your resources faster, so you can't wait 25 years, you're going to have to get there in 20 years. But to get there in 20 years, you have to use the resources faster. In other words, every time you change the boundary condition, you change everything you did to get to that boundary condition. You create a new boundary condition. So the two boundary conditions are the present and the future. And now you have to sort of calibrate this in a way that's not going to be measurable in a simple sense. Because what is it about the present that's critical? Basically, what's critical about the present is the rate at which you can create scientific and technological breakthroughs, which means it's a cultural question. It's a matter of the standard of living and state of mind of the population. So the singularities in an economic policy are the technologies, but the technologies are represented in terms of the capabilities of the population. So the singularities from an economic standpoint, while it starts with technology, the actual grid or the density of singularities, the type of singularities that you need, are characterized by the rate of development and assimilation of ideas and the generation of creative capabilities and also the freedom to exercise creative capabilities in the population, in the culture and labor power of the population. In other words, the degree to which you create a population that likes to play around with solving creative problems is the essence of economic planning, even though what may drive it is the plan to create transportation, infrastructure, power grids, and so on and so forth. And what you're looking at is something like a complex Riemannian domain. Now let me give you a sense of what this looks like from another standpoint. Just run a couple of these things so you can see a kind of geometrical conception of this. Now this, see we're starting, we go back to the beginning, if you can stop it there. This is a simple case, basically, of you're starting out with the polar projection. In other words, what you start out with is the projection of a sphere onto the plane. So you have the radial lines are straight lines, and the latitudes are circles. Now, the essential singularity in this is the center, which is the poles, the south and north and south pole of the sphere, and the center of the polar coordinates. But what happens now? As you move, what's defining the nature of this grid?
What defines the nature of it is the circular boundary and the singularity, the center. As you move the center, if you want to keep everything in the same relationship, in other words, if you want to keep the radial lines and the concentric circles orthogonal at right angles, as you move the singularity, you have to change the relationship of the radial lines to the circles. But you sustain a harmonic relationship of proportions and intersections. Now, what that tells you, in effect, is all of that, as it moves, is determined by two things. All you need is two things. The nature of the boundary, and the location, and ultimately the number of singularities. Now, I want to give you another example of this, to show you the number of singularities. This is what happens if the center moves in a circle. It's basically moving in a circle, around the center. And you get a different set of relationships. But each step is defined by where the center is and the nature of the boundary condition. That gives you the relationship between the sphere and the plane. So if you tilt the sphere, if you roll it around, you get a series of different projections, all defined by the same conditions. Okay? Now, well, you can see if you can do one, it's the ellipse. Yeah. Now, here's a case. You basically have two singularities. Right? You have an ellipse, and you have the two foci. Now, we're going to keep everything in the same relationship as we change the nature as the foci move. That's obviously a more complex relationship because the ellipse is a boundary condition that has changing curvature in it, so it changes as the singularities move. But again, the whole thing, huh? Well, as the foci move, in this case, in some ordered relationship that stays together, in order to keep the hyperbola, these are hyperbolic lines actually, in the same relationship to the original ellipses, you have to keep changing the relationship of both the ellipse and the hyperbole. So it's all defined by the original boundary condition and the two singularities. Okay? Maybe if you have that last one, you can just show that. That's more complicated. Right? Now we have something that's different. This is a series of ellipses. Actually, it's somewhat of a lemniscate. And the ellipses and the hyperbola that are connecting them. All right? All right? And it gets more complicated. Huh? Put it back up. Well, here's the singularity. Here and here, right? And the boundary condition is really, this is really a lemniscate. So it's the center line and the two circles that are around the foci of the lemniscate. Okay? Anyway, so that's an idea. You begin to get an idea. Now, in a sense, Riemann's breakthrough was to realize that you could define the nature of a geometry, or actually the nature of a family of functions, a set of functions, by a certain type of boundary condition and the number of singularities contained within it. One center, two foci, and so on and so forth. And as you increase the singularities and the nature of the boundary conditions, this was equivalent to introducing a new physical principle. And these things are extremely relevant, for example, in electromagnetism, where you take the north and south pole and you generate an electromagnetic field by a certain kind of motion and changing of the poles. Okay, and these are the kinds of things that Gauss was looking at. This is how you measure the electromagnetic field, the gravitational field of the planet. And then you realize that the Earth is a combination of a gravitational and electromagnetic field. So you have two different kinds of surfaces. And these are the kinds of things you have to look at. Yeah. Yeah, because the outer boundary didn't have to change. You could keep all the relationships the same as the singularity moved, and because the circle is a completely constant curvature, you don't have to change it. When you change the singularities in the ellipse, remember the ellipse has a changing curvature. So now as you change the singularity to keep the radial lines and all the same, you actually have to change the shape of the ellipse itself. So it's a more complicated relationship. Okay? Now, the best thing to do is just to keep some of this in mind as a conception. And remember, for Riemann and company, all these things really do, to use a word, they function as, they function as a way of generating a larger idea in the mind. And this is, to a certain extent, where Cantor's conception comes in, even though it gets, as I said, it gets formalized. Now, the interesting thing to me to look at is, look, what happens? In a sense, when you get to a certain density of singularities, you have to change the entire relationship. Now, for example, what did I say about the economic example? If you introduce a new technology, you can't just introduce a new technology. There's a new science behind it. There's a different set of ideas. So you have to change the ideas in the population. And you're also going to have to change, in almost every case, the numbers of people who are capable of functioning and comprehending the most advanced ideas of that science in order to use the technology and develop the technology. In effect, in order to develop the technology, you have to develop the science first. And so you have to then literally transform the manifold of social relations, living standards, etc., to be able to carry that economic policy through over time. Yeah. Well, in one sense, what I'm saying is that to a certain extent, you can make changes within the science by adding given technologies that don't represent a scientific change. So then you're simply adding a certain kinds of singularities and changes in the labor within a given scientific domain. Okay? You got to introduce a change in principle. And that means you're going to have to increase the density of scientific activity in the population. Now, in a sense, and this is where Cantor's idea comes in, and why Lynn wanted to use this to get across this idea of a transfinite. Yeah, I'm about. Don't worry. Okay. To get across this idea of the transfinite, and this will be the starting point of how to look at Cantor more than anything else. Because if you don't look at Cantor the right way, it's a bit of a mess. Okay. So, what is it that Cantor demonstrates in a very interesting way. He's looking at, really, I'll race through this a little bit. He's looking at an interesting problem in physics, which is if you take for want of a better word, the algebraicists, so the formalists. If you take Lagrange, Laplace, and company, they like to deal with what they call analytic functions. An analytic function, in the simplest terms, is just a nice smooth function. It's a nice smooth curve that you can easily represent by some algebraic or even trigonometric representation. However, what people like Dirichlet and Fourier and others were looking at, and some of them were mixed bags, but what they were looking at was, what about just any old, when you're dealing with a physical process, you can't ask the physical process to be smooth. You can't say, no, like, forget all the little bumps and the little, jumps and so on and so forth. Can you represent any arbitrary function? any arbitrary physical path. And what they began to do was work on the representability of arbitrary functions, and which included any arbitrary physical process. And what they were working on is, what are the conditions under which you can represent a function that has an arbitrary number of singularities in it, an arbitrary number of jumps or radical shifts, like, something that goes like this. Because the rate of change at this point is infinite. It makes a turn. It's a complete change in direction. Okay? So how do you represent that? Or how do you represent a function that might actually have what they would call a discontinuity in it? And there are physical problems. You take the way in which heat is distributed. If you take a disk and put it in hot water and try to measure the distribution of the heat, you'll find that there are radical shifts. It's not a nice, smooth way in which the heat is distributed. The temperature gradient is not smooth. So how do you do these things? You have the same kind of things in electromagnetic phenomena, where you get, for example, a jump. We know today, for example, what causes what happens when an electromagnetic field reverses, where the North Pole becomes the South Pole and the South Pole becomes the North Pole, as happens on the planet Earth every few hundred thousand years. Okay? So what people like Fourier and particularly Dirichlet and so forth are looking at is, and I won't get into some of the technical stuff, but how do you represent that? How do you integrate a function like this? And what are the conditions under which you can do it? Well, in effect, what people like Riemann and Dirichlet, as they were defining these functions in terms of their boundary conditions and minimums and maximums, singularities, they realized that, in effect, there were many, many conditions under which you could represent these functions by largely trigonometric functions, or what we would call transcendental functions, or exponential functions, complex functions, largely complex functions. Because trigonometric functions and complex functions are basically the same thing. Now, what Cantor realized is, in effect, if you took in the normal plane, you could take an infinite number, or what he calls a countably infinite number, of singularities. That is, 1, 2, 3, 4, as far as you can go. A countably infinite number of singularities and still represent the function. You could take all these little points out in a certain way, and you could still represent the function with a trigonometric function. Now, that's a paradox. It tells you something. There's something different about the continuum, the plane that you're dealing with, and what you might think. It appears to be you could take everything out of it and still represent it with a continuous function of some kind or other. Now, what Cantor realizes is, well, if that's the case, then there's something there that we're not comprehending. There's something beyond the countable number of singularities. There's something which he called transfinite to the countable domain, which still exists, and which is really the basis of the countable domain. Now, what he then demonstrated was, and he approached this philosophically. I'll just look at a couple of things and we'll wrap it up because we get it. But he has approached this philosophically. He approached it epistemologically. He said, look, what this tells you, because what is this? This is something generated by the human mind as applied to the physical universe. It's a relationship between the human mind and the physical universe. Now, he had some problems with some of this, but this is still the basic idea. That what we're doing is we're taking a concept, an idea, which itself has certain boundary conditions, certain limits. And as we come up to those limits, it's possible that we can generate a new idea, a new conception, something transfinite to the original conception, which is the generative idea that produced the original conception. It's not in it, but it produces it. So, for example, the idea of counting numbers. You don't know any infinite counting number. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, etc. You never have an infinite number. There's no such thing as an infinite number. Not an actual integer. Because any integer, by definition, is finite. Okay? Yet, you can think of the totality of the counting numbers. And that's a kind of infinite. Now, Cantor's view, like others, was that that was a somewhat not the best kind of infinite. Because you never really get to the infinite, though you can think of the generative principle as a totality. But then he realized, he said, look, if we take that process and do it over and over again, let's take the totality of the numbers and add one number to it. Now I've got something beyond the counting numbers, but it partly has the character of the counting numbers. However, he said, if I do this again and again, and I take the totality of all of those, then I generate something that's completely new. Or take the idea of the real numbers, which are different than the counting numbers. Why? Because the real numbers, because of the history of numbers, really, because of the history of what we've done, you have square roots. You have irrationals. Then you have transcendentals. Now, it turns out that if you want to handle transcendentals, like pi, you need to write them down as an infinite number, an infinite decimal. And by the way, it has nothing to do with a base 10. No matter what base you use, you'd have to write it down as an infinite number. And it's an infinite non-repeating number. There's no way to predict the next number. Like if you have 2/7, you can predict the next number. 2/7 is a fraction. 2/7 is, 0.2857, et cetera, et cetera. And then it repeats. It's just 857, 857, 857, something like that. Okay? I forget the exact, but you can get it. It can't have more than six numbers in it. Okay? And by the way, this is related to Gauss's disquisitions. A simple rule. If the denominator is 7, you can't have more than six remainders. Because if you have seven remainders, then 7 has to be one of them, and that's not a remainder. Okay? Because 7 goes into 7 one time. If you have 5, it can't have more than 4 remainders. It'll repeat. Now, a very interesting question. Why is it that transcendental numbers don't repeat? It means they don't have an integral denominator. Then that's a funny number. Okay, and therefore it can't be a rational number because all rational denominators have integrals that you can convert into an integral number. So it's got to have a non-rational denominator. Now we can take something that's not doesn't appear to be infinite, a line, for example, and we find that the number of positions on the line, if we take that as measuring, for example, a transcendental number, if we unroll the circle and so forth, the number of positions on the line is greater than the number of counting numbers. Really, it's greater is a bad way to look at it. People like to look at it that way. It's a bigger infinite. It's a bigger number. But what it means is you can't put the counting numbers or the rational numbers into a one-to-one correspondence with the transcendentals, with the number line including the transcendentals. In that sense, the real numbers or the transcendentals have a greater magnitude. So what Cantor says is, well, this tells us something about our concept of universals, universality. There are different qualities, measurably different qualities of universal ideas, of what he calls transfinites, not really infinites. In a sense, what he's saying is that you reach a certain boundary condition that changes the whole nature of what's inside those boundary conditions. Now, from there, it becomes a little more complicated. And he runs into some problems, which are interesting. But what we do know is that if you start with any bounded totality that contains at least an uncountable number of parts, or a countably infinite number of parts, if you take all the internal relations, that is what's called the function space, all the internal relations inside of that boundary, you come up with something that's uncountable by the things inside of the boundary. You move to a new boundary condition. So in principle, you might say the sequence of transfinites generated this way, or the power series of this, it's interesting because he did call them Mächtigkeit. The power sequence of these infinite totalities generates a sequence of ever greater power. Now, what Cantor did was he developed certain concepts about, if you like, the mathematics of these kinds of numbers, which are interesting. But he got caught up in some awful formalities and some mistakes. But what Lin did was he took this idea of the generation of a sequence of ever greater powers by the introduction of new conditions and new types of singularities. And he took that as a model for understanding the application of Riemann's conception to the development of physical economy. And that's the real point of this. It's a conception of the development of the powers of the human mind, the kind of human individual and social relations that you have to generate to change the conditions, the boundary conditions of human existence, in a sense to redefine human power over nature and relations. Now, I'll give you a quote, two different quotes, and then we'll end on that, because I think sometimes it's better. This is really, in a sense, what I'm saying, this is really, look, we have to look at the science that we're doing from this standpoint. You have to look at some of the problems in modern science, the so-called wave-particle duality, quantum effects. We have to, in a sense, go back to this conception of the development of science to begin to grapple with these problems and make substantial breakthroughs in controlling these powers. When the youth movement is looking at Gauss, at Riemann, what you're trying to do is get back to a standpoint from which we can make further discoveries, get a grasp of how the human mind actually operates so that we can address the issue in the minds of the population, in the epistemology of the population. You operate from that standpoint, I don't think fundamentalism is all that big a problem. At least shouldn't be for us. Okay? Now, I give you a sense of first Riemann, because they're a little different on this, and these are things to look at. But two quick things, and I'm going to finish. But they are really short. Okay. This one. Now, actually, you see the problem. He refers to Newton here, but it's from the Fragments. Let me see. Instead of consisting of a continuous transition from one value of a magnitude to another one, or from one position to another one, or in general from one method of determination of a concept to another method, this method examines, first of all, a transition by way of a finite number of intermediate stages. And then it allows the number of these intermediate stages to increase in such a fashion that the intervals between two successive intermediate stages all decrease to the infinite. So he's saying you start out with a finite number of steps of going from one place to another, and you reach and you continue that process stepwise infinitely. The conceptual systems of the antithesis are conceptions that are firmly determined through negative predicates, However, they are not representable in a positive manner.
Now he's saying, in a sense, to go beyond the boundary. The antithesis of what you've done is not representable positively, but only from a standpoint of a negative of what it's not. For the very reason that an exact and complete representation of these conceptual systems is impossible, they are inaccessible to direct investigation and molding by our reflection and deliberation. But they can be considered to be lying on the border of the representable, i.e. one can form a conceptual system which lies within the boundaries of the representable, and which through a mere change in the order of magnitude is transformed into the given conceptual system. Now that, think about what he's saying now. But they can be considered to be lying on the border of the representable. So to go from one manifold to the next, one can form a conceptual system which lies within the boundaries of the representable, and which through a mere change in the order of magnitude is transformed into the given conceptual system. Apart from the order of magnitude, the conceptual system remains unchanged in the transition to the limit. But in the limiting case itself, some of the correlative conceptions of the systems lose their representability, and in particular, they are those which mediate the relationship between other concepts. Now, I would say that he's clearly getting to this idea that at the point of change, at the point of movement from one set of boundary conditions and type of singularity to the next, this requires the intervention of a new hypothesis, a totally transformative idea that's going to transform everything that went before it and in effect solve the problem that you face at the boundary, and that these are not representable within the given system. This, in a sense, is the invisible domain, but it's the domain of the human mind. This is the domain of the introduction of a transfinite alteration in previously existing conditions. This is the domain of physical economic planning, where you're actually planning scientific discovery, planning the development of new ideas. Now, it's also here where he refers to this, but I'll only reference this. And this is what Lin's idea of using Cantor's conception to reflect on Riemann's breakthroughs in topology, mathematics, and so forth. Now, this actually addresses the question that Eddie asked. And the basis for the general laws of motion for ponderables, which are found assembled at the beginning of Newton's principles, lies in the inner state of the latter. Let us try to deduce it by way of analogy from our own inner mode of perception. New imagination masses, this is Geistesmassen, new Geistesmassen constantly arise in us and very rapidly disappear again from our consciousness. We observe a continuous activity of our soul. Every act of the latter is based upon something permanent, which on special occasions, through memory, gives note of itself as such, without exerting a lasting influence upon the appearances. Thus, constantly, with every thought act, something permanent enters our soul, which, however, does not exert a lasting influence upon the world of appearances. Thus, every act of our soul is based upon something permanent, which with this act enters our soul, but at the same moment completely disappears from the world of appearances. Every idea, every thought, and ultimately a thought that determines a universal conception. And in effect, that's what Cantor is talking about. When he talks about a generative principle, he's talking about a Geistesmaß, a thought object that is a principle that organizes our intervention into the universe. It doesn't exist as a ponderable mass. It exists as a change in the way a human being thinks and perceives the world. Now, these are things that we have to take into account of. I'm going to leave it at, in the economics to get into more, would lead us to more complicated territory. But this is what we're dealing with. This is the whole point of going through the Gauss, the Riemann. This is the value of Cantor. It's rooted in this
relationship of human activity to our existence in the physical universe, to our discoveries, to our exploration of the universe. And this tells us that we can know. See, we can know that we have the basis for solving the problems. It may be a little difficult if we're not fundamentalists. We don't think you can wake up and read it in a textbook or the Bible. As Lynn at one time said, it's written in the stones. That's, in a sense, that's where God wrote his story, in the universe. So that's the book that you have to read. A lot of pages. All right? It's lunch.